Okay, today is July 26, 2014. Okay, we'll begin with the homage to the Buddha.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa.
Good morning, everybody. Okay, so we've been reading the Anapanasati Sutta. This is Sutta number 118 in the Middle Length Discourses, and this is the Sutta on mindfulness and breathing. Okay, and so far in the sequence on mindfulness and breathing, we've covered the what I call the basic step, or the foundation, which is in paragraph 17. That is, having sat down, cross the legs, set the body erect, and set up mindfulness in front of him. Ever mindful, he breathes in. Mindful, he breathes out. So that is really, you could say, the foundation or basis for the whole practice of mindfulness of breathing. And I just wanted to say something. I don't think I spoke last week about this expression, establish mindfulness in front of him, which in Pali, it's parimukkang satting upatapetva. And the key word here is parimukkang. So the word mukang by itself can mean the face or the mouth, more specifically the mouth. And the prefix pari gives the sense of around. So when you take pari mukang together, literally it would have the sense of around the face or around the mouth. And so this becomes the basis in the commentaries for the statement that when you set up or practice mindfulness of breathing, you set up the mindfulness around the nostrils or on the upper lip, just above the mouth. Years ago I had investigated this expression, and I found that it seems to be used in a sense that it seems to be used sometimes in such a way that it should not be taken too literally. So it could be taken simply as setting up mindfulness without indicating a specific place. But because if it's taken literally, it indicates around the mouth, therefore the commentators say that when you practice mindfulness of breathing, the attention should be fixed around the nostrils, the upper lip, wherever one feels the impact of the breath coming in or going out. But I know the teachers who teach mindfulness of breathing without focusing the breath, but without focusing mindfulness on the breath in that specific place. Even I remember hearing a recording of Achan Brahmavangso, who's a great advocate of mindfulness of breathing. And he said to follow the breath wherever one could feel most distinctly and clearly the motion of the body that's connected with breathing in and breathing out. And so though I used to take the expression quite literally, now I take a sort of broader interpretation. I don't know about Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh. Does he ever specify a particular place to observe the breath? No, he just says, be aware of the breath. Does he give choices of here? He doesn't mention any place, just be aware of the breathing. So my advice to people who are practicing, of course, if you're practicing under a teacher who says, focus on the breath in this area, then you should follow their instructions. But if you're practicing on your own, you can experiment and see where you feel the impression of the breath coming in and out most distinctly. As I think I mentioned last week, there are times when I have this heaviness in the head and I don't want to focus on the breathing there. So where I observe the impact of the breath is on the buttocks, where when you breathe in, there's an increase in the pressure because sort of there's an expansion of the body, and so the buttocks are pressing more forcefully upon the cushion. Then when one breathes out, there's a sort of light lifting of that pressure. And so one could be following the breath in quite minute detail just through the pressure sensation on the buttock, on the buttocks. Now, if this gets on YouTube, there's going to be a revolution. A whole generation is going to grow up practicing mindfulness of breathing on the Buddha. Okay, so we have the basic practice of mindfulness of breathing indicated by that one phrase, ever mindful one breathes in, mindful one breathes out. Then comes a set of four phases in which one observes whether the breath is long, whether it's short. Then comes the controversial phrase, experiencing the whole body, Sabbakaya Patisangvedi, which I explained last week. There are two interpretations of that, either as literally getting the sense of the whole body as one is breathing in, breathing out, or sort of the more established interpretation of the commentaries. It means that as you breathe in, you become aware of the entire in-breath from its inception through the drawing in of the breath to the very end of the in-breath, then as you breathe out, you become aware of the entire out-breath from its beginning through the whole extent of the out-breath to the end, but always keeping the attention in the place where the post of observation, not following the breath from the nostrils, down the windpipe, into the lungs, down to the bottom of the lungs, and then from the bottom of the lungs, up and out. Okay, and then lastly comes breathing in, tranquilizing the bodily formation. And then, as we explained last time, the bodily formation is explained in some suttas to be the process of in and out breathing. So this, in effect, means breathing in and out, tranquilizing the body. I'm sorry, tranquilizing the breath. But on a wider interpretation, one might take the bodily formation to be the sense of everything connected with the breath going on in the body. Because as the breath becomes more tranquil, all the other kind of micro activities, molecular activities associated with the breath, the nervous activities, muscular activities, even molecular activities will become more tranquil. Okay, so now we come to the new section. So here we have the text says, he trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing rapture. He trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing rapture. Then let's take the next pair. He trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing pleasure. He trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing pleasure. Now the two key words in these two steps of mindfulness of breathing are Piti Pati Sangvedi and Sukha Pati Sangvedi. And now, if you're familiar with the formula for the first jhana, you know that what's emphasized in the formula for the first jhana is precisely these two qualities of Piti and Sukha. For example, if you look at the formula for the first jhana, let's see. For example, on page 275, paragraph 19, it speaks about how the meditator abandons the five hindrances and enters and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. So what is being indicated in these two steps or phases of mindfulness of breathing is the arising of these two sort of powerful emotive or felt qualities, which will eventually, when developed to a certain sufficient degree of strength, will become the dominant factors in the first jhana. Is the recording okay?
The recording is okay. It's a low hum noise.
Coming from the device?
Not sure, maybe the frequency.
Okay, now there is a difference between piti or rapture and sukha, in that piti, in terms of a technical classification, piti or rapture is assigned, you know, of the scheme of the five aggregates. Piti or rapture is assigned to the aggregate of mental formations or volitional formations. So it's not actually a feeling, though it seems to be very closely associated with feelings, particularly with sukha. And so the word piti, it has various nuances, different translations, sometimes joy, elation, upliftment, exhilaration. Even in its stronger degree, we might render it as ecstasy. I can use that word without seeing flashing colors and and piti, rapture, is a somewhat coarser quality than sukha. Sukha, or pleasure, belongs in the scheme of the five aggregate, it belongs to the aggregate of feelings. So pleasure is one of the feelings of the three types: pleasant feeling, painful feeling, neutral feeling. So sukha is the pleasant feeling. And whenever rapture arises, it's always accompanied by pleasant feeling. And so it's a bit difficult to distinguish the two. In order to distinguish the two, one has to be able to inspect the state of mind and see what is piti, what is this rapture, this uplifting, exhilarating quality, and what is the pleasure. It's hard to define pleasure, but it's simply a pleasant feeling. And the distinction becomes, it's rather obscure in the early stages, because when piti arises, it's like, let's say, two girls come to a ball or a dance, and one is wearing a bright pink and red dress, like the color of this, is that like a pocketbook? Pocketbook in front of me. So one girl is coming in a pink, white, red dress, you know, with frills and ruffles, fluffles. And the other girl who's alongside her is wearing a sort of light gray dress. So when the two girls come into the dance, you know, the boys look to see who's come in. And of course, the attention is going to focus on the girl in the bright pink and red dress, right? Even though the girl in the gray dress might be prettier, but it just seems to be the natural circuitry of the male nervous system to be attracted to something which is bright and flashy rather than something which is dull and subdued. So when this piti comes up, even though it's accompanied by sukha, but one doesn't notice the sukha so clearly because the mind is getting sort of overwhelmed by the impression of this joy, delight, elation. But as the dance goes on, or as, you know, one gets accustomed to the sight of the two girls who have come into the dance hall and starts looking at them, one could see that maybe the girl in the subdued gray dress is prettier than the girl in the bright pink and red dress. You're thinking, that's a bad monk. What kind of examples does he think of? Okay, so in a similar way, once one sort of gets accustomed to these two qualities present in the mind, then one starts to see that sukha is actually more pleasant. It's subtler, more refined, and more, naturally, it's more pleasure, is more pleasant than joy or rapture. And so with continued practice, one can distinguish the difference between piti, rapture, and sukha, pleasure. And in fact, as the practice continues, even though you see in the earlier stages, you know, as the mind starts to get concentrated, as the disturbances, the obstacles, the hindrances start to subside, then they come up together, the experience of rapture and pleasure. But as one continues with the practice, then the rapture becomes more refined. It sort of settles down. And so then the pleasure becomes more prominent, and then one can distinguish the pleasure. Now, what seems to me to be interesting, the way the practice is formulated in the sutta, we have to remember that this is still mindfulness of breathing, And so the attention, at least in my understanding, should still be focused upon the in and out breath. It doesn't say that one becomes aware or focuses on rapture or focuses on pleasure, but it says, one, I shall breathe in experiencing rapture. I shall breathe out experiencing rapture. I shall breathe in experiencing pleasure. I shall breathe out experiencing pleasure. And so one continues to, I think the focus point of the training is to continue to be mindful of the breath. That is a sense of he trains thus. One is continuing to be mindful of the breath. But as the piti arises, then one knows one is experiencing piti or rapture. As the pleasure arises, one knows one is experiencing the pleasure. But one still keeps the focus on the breath. Okay, the next step is I shall breathe in experiencing the mental formation. Let's take the next two steps together. I shall breathe in experiencing the mental formation. I shall breathe out experiencing the mental formation. And then I shall breathe in tranquilizing the mental formation. I shall breathe out tranquilizing the mental formation. Now here we have the expression mental formation, which in Pali is citta sankhara. Now usually in other contexts, citta sankhara refers to volitional activities of the mind which are creating karma, particularly in the formula of dependent origination. But here it has a different sense, which again is indicated by sutta number 44. This is page 399, where it says that perception and feeling are the mental formation. And the reason given, this is in section 15, and then the reason why perception and feeling are the mental formation is that perception and feeling are mental. They are states bound up with the mind. So since here we've been concerned with rapture and pleasure, so we could say that the mental formation, since it's feeling and perception, here probably the emphasis is on feeling. And it's a little bit of a puzzle. If pleasure is a feeling, then what's the difference between experiencing pleasure and experiencing the mental formation? And I don't have a definite answer to this, but just the sort of speculation or conjecture, maybe two ways to interpret this. One is to take it that in the second step, one is focusing upon the experience of pleasure as pleasure. Whereas in the third step, one is experiencing pleasure, or it could be pain or whatever feeling arises, one is seeing that feeling just as a feeling. One is not sort of getting carried away by the particular tone of that experience, whether it be pleasant, painful, or neutral. The second interpretation is that here we could say that mental formation has a wider meaning, even though in that sutta it's said to be perception and feeling. But here we might say that it could be like the whole bundle of mental factors that are being experienced in the meditative process. But that is a little difficult, to be experiencing like a whole bundle of mental factors at the same time. So I'm inclined to go with taking it in this narrower sense of feeling, but now when it's just recognizing it as a feeling, as one breathes in and breathes out. And then as one goes on mindfully breathing in and out, then the mental formation is becoming more tranquil, more refined, because the body is becoming more tranquil, more refined. In the previous passage we had, I shall breathe in tranquilizing the bodily formation, I shall breathe out tranquilizing the bodily formation. Here we have, I shall breathe in tranquilizing the mental formation, I shall breathe out tranquilizing the mental formation. So here, just as a kind of consequence of the mindful attention to in and out breathing, both the activities of the body, whatever kind of neurological and muscular processes there are, become subtler, more tranquil, and also the mental activities become subtler and more tranquil. And so even though it says one trains thus tranquilizing, but the way it's understood, one doesn't make a deliberate effort to tranquilize the mental formation, but the deliberate effort, the training, is to be mindful of the breath. But as one is mindful of the breath, as the breath becomes subtler, quieter, more tranquil, then the mental activities will also become subtler and more tranquil. Okay, shall we go on to the... Let's go on to the next section.
When you lower your head, you touch the microphone, the audio is not that good.
Maybe I put on the robe rather than... How is this? Is this better? How is this?
Better. Can you lower your head and...
Okay.
Yeah.
This is okay?
Yeah.
Okay, so now we come to the third tetrad in mindfulness of breathing. So this says, I shall breathe in, experiencing the mind. This is... The word mind here is citta. I shall breathe out, experiencing the mind. I shall breathe in, gladdening the mind. Then he trains thus, I shall breathe out, gladdening the mind. So it seems that in this phase, the sort of focus point is on experiencing the state of mind as one is breathing in and out. Perhaps one could take this as an awareness of the thoughts that are occurring in the mind. But it seems that, the focus shouldn't be on discerning and distinguishing the individual thoughts the way one would do so if one is deliberately practicing citta upasana. Contemplation of mind as a primary meditation object. But just if any particular states of mind become prominent, one just becomes aware of them, then lets them go and brings the mind back to the in and out breathing. So this is training in breathing in, breathing out, experiencing the mind. But then a more significant stage comes with the next phrase, which is gladdening the mind. I'm not so sure that I like the word gladdening, because the Pali has a richer meaning than the English word glad. You know, I'm glad to see you. Oh, I'm glad to hear that. But this is a more really joyful, exhilarating experience. Abhipamodayam, I think is the Pali. Yeah, the word is abhipamodayang, which, what grammatical form is it? Okay, it's a present participle, nominative singular. Okay, that's not important. But it's based upon the root mood, which has the sense of joy, to experience joy. And so from this root mood, we get in the Brahmaviharas, we get mudita, which is sometimes translated sympathetic joy, altruistic joy, appreciative joy. And then we get two related nouns, pamoja and pamudita, which both have the sense of joy. And so these are closely connected with piti, with rapture. So this expression seems to be a parallel to the experience of rapture in the previous tetrad. So this is, let's say, when one is experiencing the mind, the first stage, then one is becoming aware of any particular mind states that arise, one is letting them go, and bringing the mind back to the breath, being aware of breathing in, breathing out. Then as the mind becomes more focused upon the breath, then this joy arises. And then at a certain point, one could almost like deliberately suffuse the mind with that sense of joy. And so this would be the way I understand, breathing in, let's get rid of gladdening, rejoicing the mind. Does that make sense? I shall breathe out, rejoicing the mind. So suffusing the mind with joy, with bliss. Okay, but now there seems to be a progression taking place in the next step, which is, he trains thus, I shall breathe in, concentrating the mind. I shall breathe out, concentrating the mind. So here, the focus is not getting, even though in the second stage, one is suffusing the mind with the joy, but now, since once the mind has become uplifted with joy, one doesn't want to let the mind become attached and carried away by the exhilarating experience of joy. And so one even lets the joy go and just concentrates the mind more and more, I say gently, but continuously on the breath. So concentrating the mind doesn't mean that one forcefully pushes the mind onto the breath, but one just breathes in, breathes out mindfully, and lets the mind sort of rest continuously, uninterruptedly, on the breath, coming in and going out. And the word here, which is translated concentrating, samadhang, is also, it's a present participle which is related to the noun samadhi. So the implication here, you know, when you read through the original Pali text into the relationship between the verbal expressions and the nouns that they are connected to, you see that the emphasis is upon the deepening of the samadhi experience through mindfulness of breathing. And so probably we could see here a movement into the jhana being suggested. Even though the relationship of these stages to jhana, it's not made explicit within the Anapanasati Sutta. You know, it's nothing is said at this point the meditator achieves the first jhana, at this point the second jhana. But it seems that just from the use of the words, that the implication is that one is going at least into access concentration, if not yet going into full concentration, into full jhana. Okay, then the next expression, or the next step in the process, he trains thus, I shall breathe in, liberating the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, liberating the mind. And here, if one just reads this on its face value, one can misinterpret the statement.
Okay, the expression is,
okay, the word that's used to describe the process, vimochayang, that's the word which is rendered as liberating the mind. And from this we get two possible nouns, either vimokka or vimutti, which both can be translated as liberation. Okay, now if you're reading this sort of and interpreting just on the surface, just on the apparent meaning, it seems to be saying that at this point one is attaining, you know, the ultimate liberation of the mind. But I don't think that's the actual intention here, because this is a 16-step process of training, and one is still, if one could see sort of reading into what's being described here, it's a process of deepening concentration. The text hasn't yet brought in any insight practice. And so what seems to be intended, and this is the way the commentary will explain it, is that one is liberating or releasing the mind, dropping, letting go of successively coarser factors as one progresses into deeper samadhi, deeper concentration. So initially, one liberates the mind by letting go of giving up the five mental hindrances, you know, sensual desire, ill will, dullness and drowsiness, restlessness, doubt. Then, as one enters into the first jhana, and one wants to move to the second jhana, then one has to give up, release the mind from the coarser jhana factors, thought and examination, vitaka and vichara, that as one progresses to the third jhana, then one has to liberate the mind from, even from rapture, and go enter a state of pure, blissful pleasure. And then to go from the third jhana to the fourth jhana, one has to liberate the mind from even from that pleasant feeling and go towards the feeling which is neither pleasant nor painful, the neutral or equanimous feeling. So this seems to be not the permanent, irreversible liberation of the destruction of the defilements, but this is a temporary liberation into samadhi through deepened concentration and the giving up of successfully coarser factors of the mind, the factors which are constricting the mind. Okay, at this point I'll ask whether there's any questions on anything that's been covered so far. And just first, just as a sort of overall statement to sum up the first three sectors of mindfulness of breathing. This will be actually starting from paragraph 17 through paragraph or section 20. It seems to me that these sections are all concerned with the deepening of samadhi, but with the practice of what is called samatha, that is tranquility meditation, serenity meditation, not yet with the practice of insight or vipassana.
Oh, sorry, that was my question. Yeah, okay.
That was your question.
Well, if you have insight in the comments, in the state that are raptured in the mode of insight, thinking you don't have to go.
Wait, I'm not getting. I'm not sure that this one is working. Now I think she increased the volume. Okay, go on.
Yeah. Okay, when he brings up the 118 under the notes, he states that rapture is in the mode of insight. But you're saying that it's not
vipassana,
so which insight
they are... Well, yes, yeah, I mean, this is a good point. The commentary is trying to explain all of the sections in terms of both serenity and insight. And so it's explaining how one, each of these stages which are mentioned can be interpreted in terms of serenity, either serenity practice or insight. And so it will say that one is experiencing rapture, you know, as one starts to gain insight, knowledge, then the experience of rapture will arise.
So you can't get vipassana in the process of doing the dhyanas, you say, you know?
Say again?
So you could actually experience vipassana in the process of doing the dhyanas, you say?
No. I mean, one can, but the commentary is explaining how... The commentary is interpreting each of these stages in terms of both serenity and insight, because it's using sort of the commentarial scheme of interpretation for interpreting the sutta. But I'm sort of putting the commentary aside and saying if one looks at what seems to be the underlying intention of the original text without using the commentarial system, then it seems to me pretty clear that it's moving within the mode of serenity meditation,
okay,
towards greater concentration.
Thanks.
By saying this, I'm not invalidating the commentarial explanation, but I'm just saying that what seems to be the original intention of the text is that these stages belong to the development of concentration or serenity.
Yeah. In other words, you're still not at insight level yet. You should have marked insight.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see that the insight is coming in the fourth tetrad.
The fourth tetrad.
Yeah. Okay. Let me just take the internet question first. Okay, this is an interesting question. So the question comes up, does the experience of rapture in the second tetrad happen first, or the gladdening the mind in the third tetrad happens first, or do they happen concurrently? It's an interesting question, because it seems to me that these two tetrads are actually describing the same process from two different points of view. The second tetrad, as we're going to see when we come to the next major section of the sutta, the second tetrad is subsumed under contemplation of feeling. So this is describing the process of what occurs as the mind becomes more deeply concentrated on the breath. It's describing what is occurring in that experience from the perspective of feeling, or at least with a greater emphasis on the feeling aspect. Whereas the third tetrad is describing the same process, but from the perspective of what is happening in the mind. And so I take the experience of rapture, breathing in and out, experiencing rapture, and breathing in and out, gladdening the mind, to be actually describing the same experience from the two different points of view, either focusing on the rapture itself, that is in the second tetrad, or in the third tetrad, what is happening to the mind as it's being suffused by that rapture. And so it's the same thing occurring, but it seems that because citta would be a subtler factor than, that's citta, mind, is a subtler factor than feeling. So perhaps we could say that in the third tetrad, one is able to observe more subtly what is happening within that experience of rapture. One is able to observe how the mind is suffused by the rapture. Whereas in the second tetrad, because we're still at a coarser level, the focus is upon the rapture itself rather than the way the rapture is suffusing or pervading the mind. But it's still the same process, but just observed from either a coarser or a subtler point of view. At least that's the way I take it. Was there another question? Oh, I'm sorry, you had a question. Yes.
Let me spend 1 minute. If you're talking to my movies, but then after you're talking movie time, there's interference. It's all in one time. Thank you. I wish to hear something more of an explanation about Vimokkhayam and coming into Vimokkha and Vimutti. What are the differences, how it arrives differently? Vimokkha and Vimutti.
The difference between Vimokkha and Vimutti?
Yes.
I think that would take us a little bit sort of away from the topic of that would take us away from the study of the sutta itself into a rather technical discussion of differences in the use of Buddhist terms. It's just sufficient for understanding this passage of the sutta to realize that what's being intended here by liberating the mind is not attaining at this point the ultimate liberation, where the mind is released from all of the defilements permanently, but rather it's a temporary releasing or letting go first of the defilements and then of the coarser mental factors, so that the mind can move into deeper stages of meditative absorption.
Thank you.
That's sufficient for the understanding the sutta. Okay, let us move on now into the fourth tetrad, because it's at this point that we come to the development of insight. And this tetrad begins with, I shall breathe in contemplating impermanence. He trains thus, I shall breathe out contemplating impermanence. Okay, now the sort of key question, of course different teachers have different methods, but how does one make the transition, assuming the first three major sections are concerned with concentrating the mind? How does one make the transition in mindfulness of breathing from the mode of serenity or tranquility or concentration to the mode of insight? Okay, the way that I learned from my teacher in Sri Lanka is, to move to the development of insight, one starts off by making a clear distinction between in-breath and out-breath. So it's not just that the distinction of in-breath and out-breath is sort of in the back of the mind as one is focusing upon the sensation of the breath, but rather one is clearly discerning the difference between in-breath and out-breath, in-breath and out-breath. Because at the time one is breathing in, the previous out-breath is gone. The in-breath comes to an end, one sees the in-breath has come to an end. Then it's replaced by the out-breath, and then the out-breath comes to an end. And so one is distinguishing ending of in-breath, ending of out-breath, ending of in-breath, ending of out-breath. Okay, then once, after one is able to clearly distinguish over some time the difference between in-breath, out-breath, in-breath, out-breath, and the ending of in-breath, ending of out-breath, then one divides the in-breath into the three phases: initial phase, middle phase, end phase. And then the out-breath, initial phase, middle phase, initial phase, middle phase, end phase. And with the in-breath, one sees the initial phase comes to an end, replaced by the middle phase. Middle phase comes to an end, replaced by the end phase. End phase of the in-breath comes to an end, replaced by the initial phase of the out-breath, then middle phase of the out-breath, end phase of the out-breath. And then one continues this for some time. And so now one is able to see the impermanence even within one in-breath of each phase of the in-breath. And within the out-breath, one sees the impermanence of each of the three phases within the out-breath. Okay, now when the mind becomes well focused upon this distinction, one could start focusing upon how within the in-breath, or how an in-breath is constituted, even though it appears superficially to be continuous, but there are actually a whole succession of little movements, little jerky movements within an in-breath, and a whole succession of little jerky movements without an out-breath. So one is starting to see how, well, to use an analogy, it's like if one is watching a movie, you know, it seems to be the cowboy is riding off into the sunset on his horse, and it looks like he's just moving continuously closer and closer to the horizon. But if you take the strip of the film and you look, and it's like one little frame of the film, the cowboy and the horse is here. The next frame, he's there. Or even if you're watching the film, if the projector is turned into really slow motion, you start to see the individual frames. And so you see how each frame is discrete. And so now one is seeing how each in-breath is made up of a whole succession of little frames of breathing in, and how the out-breath is made up of a succession of little frames of breathing out. And so each of these, one could see, is distinct. And each one, as the mind becomes more sort of refined in its focus, each one has an arising and a cessation. So now one is contemplating impermanence through the in-breath and out-breath, and then one learns to be able to extend that awareness to embrace all, from the breath to all five aggregates. So one could extend it, so one is, while breathing in and out, one is observing how the body itself is a succession, or it's a constant flux, a succession of physical events always arising and passing away, and how what we call the mind is also a succession of events, feelings, perceptions, volitions, consciousness arising and passing away. So now one is observing the arising and passing away of the five aggregates in connection with the in and out breathing. So this becomes contemplating impermanence while breathing in, while breathing out. Okay, now comes the second step here, which is, I shall breathe in, contemplating fading away. I shall breathe out, contemplating fading away. Now this is a rather tricky phrase. Let me just take, I'll clear these, we don't need these anymore. The second one, I say, it's a little bit tricky because the word, the expression here is virag anupassi. Okay, now the suffix here, anupassi, is what's translated as contemplating, or could be rendered observing. It's based on the root or the verb passati, which means to see, with the prefix anu, which suggests closely. So it's closely seeing. And the first, which we just discussed, is anicca-anupassi, contemplating impermanence. Now the second one, viraga-anupassi, the reason it's tricky is because of the word viraga. Now the word viraga, in most contexts, means the absence of raga. And what is raga? You might know about the Indian musical compositions, which are called ragas. If you've heard like Ravi Shankar or Ali Akbar Khan, You know, the musical compositions are called ragas. The word raga originally had the sense of color, especially a color obtained by dyeing cloth. And so the musical compositions are called ragas because each one is based on a scale which is supposed to convey a very specific mood which is connected to a particular season of the year, a particular time of day. So there are morning ragas, afternoon ragas, evening ragas, and it's said that in the classical period, if a really master Indian musician started to play a morning raga in the evening, the sun would reverse course, the birds would start chirping. Okay, so raga originally has the sense of a color, especially a color obtained by dyeing. And then within the spiritual philosophies of India, it takes on the meaning of passion or lust, because passion is what sort of suffuses the mind the way dye will suffuse a cloth. And so the ideal for the Indian spiritual systems, not only Buddhism, but also the yoga systems, the Vedantic systems, is viraga, which means dispassion, the overcoming of the passions, the attachments. And so within most places in the Buddhist texts, where the Buddha speaks about viraga, he means dispassion or detachment, the ending of attachment. And so even sometimes nibbana is equated with viraga. You know, it's the extinction of craving, and viraga, nirodha, virago tanha kayo nirodho nibbanam. So it's the extinction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. But when a cloth is dyed and then it's washed over time, what happens is that the color fades out from the cloth. So the cloth loses its color. So another meaning of viraga is fading out, fading away. And so within some contexts, it takes on the meaning, it's a kind of extended meaning of impermanence. And so sometimes in the Anapanasati Sutta or in other places in the Buddhist suttas concerned with contemplation, this phrase viraganupassi could be translated contemplation of dispassion. It's not exactly correct here, but we have to recognize the way meanings of words sometimes, let's say when one word has multiple meanings in a particular context, even though one of those meanings is intended, but the other nuances will also sort of overlap and reverberate through it. And so I think that is taking place here, though the prominent meaning of contemplating viraga is contemplating the fading away of phenomena, but sort of what is giving a particular color, a particular echo to that expression is in the background is the sense of growing dispassion, increasing dispassion. And so the way I would understand the distinction between contemplating impermanence and contemplating fading away, actually the fading away that's taking place here is not a slow and gradual fading away. but rather this is a focus upon the aspect of passing away of things. Like in contemplating impermanence, one is observing the very rapid arising and passing away, arising and passing away, or the persistence and passing away, persistence and passing away. But as the focus of the mind becomes sharper, more persistent, more precise, what happens is that the awareness of arising and persistence falls into the background, and what stands out as prominent is the passing away. So that with the in-breath, it seems that each little, what I call the jerk of the breath, is just experienced as a succession of events of vanishing, 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 vanishing. The out-breath, each little jerk of the out-breath is experienced as a succession of vanishing, 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 vanishing. And then when it's extended to all of the five aggregates, then one is experiencing everything within the mind-body compound as just breaking up and passing away, breaking up and passing away. So it becomes a process of continuous dissolution, dissolving and passing away. And then that leads into the Nirodhanupassi, which is the contemplation of cessation. And the way I understand the distinction between this and contemplation of fading away is that in Nirodhanupassi, contemplating cessation, what stands out is the fact that whatever existed at the previous moment is no longer there. So that with the Raganupassi, one is seeing, for example, the body, all the physical processes in the body are just breaking up and vanishing, breaking and vanishing, breaking and vanishing. With Nirodhanupassi, one is cognizant or aware that that bodily process is gone, that process is gone, that one is gone, that one is gone. That has ceased, this is ceased. So everything is constantly ceasing and gone, gone, gone. So this gives that really sense, distinctive sense, that nothing has any stability, any persistence, but everything is just breaking up and vanishing and gone, disappeared. And then that leads into the fourth stage of contemplation, which is contemplation of relinquishment. And this can be understood as simply relinquishing, because one is seeing that everything within the five aggregates is constantly just breaking up and passing away, there comes the relinquishing of any grasping or clinging to anything within the five aggregates. And so whatever arises in the mind, one just lets it go, lets it go, lets it go. Whatever is experienced within form, feeling, perception, mental activities, consciousness, because one is observing, it's breaking up and passing away. One is just lets it go, lets it go, lets it go. So this is contemplation of relinquishment. So these are the four tetras concerned with insight. And so then the Buddha sort of sums up and says, this is how mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated so that it is of great fruit and great benefit. There was a marvelous book. I don't know whether we have it in the library, but we should get it. It was written by the meditation master of Mitarigala Hermitage in Sri Lanka, Venerable Mata Sri Jnanarama. It was called, I think it's called, The Seven Contemplations of Insight. He takes the scheme of not simply these four, but it gets expanded in some later works into seven contemplations, and then he gives very detailed explanations of these seven contemplations, both based on the text and also from the standpoint of personal experience. I'll have to check with Kaidi to see if we have it and ask her to order it if we don't have a copy. Okay, then we could ask whether there's any questions. Please. Take the microphone. It's been passed.
Thank you, Bhante. Yeah. Is this phase of the breaking up, the fading out, the vanishing, is that commensurate with the quality of Bhanga?
Yeah. That's what in the Visuddhimagga, I'm not sure whether this already comes in the Patisambhidamagga, but this is sort of what comes to be called Bhangajnana. It's the knowledge of dissolution. It's described very beautifully, very graphically in the Visuddhimagga with a number of similes. Like, I think it uses a simile of like a line of pots set out on a shelf, and then somebody takes a rod and sort of smashes all of them so that one pot hits the other, which breaks, which hits the next one, which breaks, which hits the next one, which breaks. Take the mobile microphone.
Not related to mindfulness or breathing, but a general question. Earlier you had the word vimukti and moksha.
Yeah.
In Hinduism also I believe there's moksha.
Yeah.
Is this the same? Or, because sometimes vimukti, some people try to say that it's the same as nibbana, a moksha. So could it be, can it be sort of mixed up? But we always use the word nibbana, never moksha. But in Hinduism, they say moksha.
Occasionally, the Buddhist texts do use the word, of course, in Pali it comes out mokha, which is the same word as in Sanskrit moksha. Okay, in the Hindu traditions, the word moksha is used most often to describe the ultimate goal. So it means release, deliverance, liberation. In early Buddhism, the word which is used more often is vimutti, which comes from the same root. And so etymologically, they're pretty much the same, though conceptually they're different because Buddhism and Hinduism are working with different philosophical foundations. So they both have the sense of the ultimate liberation from samsara. But it's just that Hinduism has a dozen different schools, but they'll conceive liberation according to the particular tenets of the different Hindu schools, whereas in Buddhism, liberation is conceived in accordance with the Buddhist philosophical foundations.
And Buddhism, we have anatta.
Yeah, that would sort of be the key difference, that in Hindu, the different Hindu schools, there's some idea of the Atman, the self as the agent of liberation, or that which receives undergoes liberation. Whereas in Buddhism, liberation comes through the insight into non-self. Victor.
I was wondering, here we talk about insights into the five aggregates.
Yep.
And is it possible, have you read anywhere of like any disciple of the Buddha or any other practitioner having these insights just without going through these stages, like just having, like maybe they were just walking and all of a sudden they just had this insight after maybe reading the Dhamma so many times that they just suddenly clicked in their head, like some kind of epiphany, or is it, do you have to go through?
Yeah, this is an interesting question. Because one does see quite often in the texts that particularly in situations where somebody is coming to the Buddha, often for the first time, or the Buddha is giving it discourse to a large audience, but there's somebody in the audience who is, their faculty is ripe for awakening. And so it says that as the Buddha was speaking for such and such a person, his mind became calm, settled, clear, free from the hindrances. And then as the Buddha spoke, the Buddha then turned the topic of the discourse to the Four Noble Truths. Then it said that as, say, Siha the general sat there, there arose in his mind the dust-free, stainless vision of the Dhamma. Whatever is subject to arising is subject to cessation. And then he penetrates the truth of the Dhamma, and then he comes out as a stream enterer. And so one sees, you know, passages like that, and the text never describe what is taking place in his mind at a micro level, but it seems hard to believe that he's going through each of these insights. What seems to me to be the case that this would happen with somebody who has practiced in previous lives, and so has the faculties would be quite mature, you know, very, it's like a fruit which is very ripe, just ready to drop from the tree, and then as soon as a wind blows, even a gentle breeze, it drops from the tree. But if it weren't gradually maturing as it was hanging in the tree, then even if a powerful wind were to blow, it wouldn't drop from the tree.
And also, are there other insights that we can have, like insights into the Four Noble Truths? For example,
yeah.
That's
yeah. Well, usually what's the realest, let's say, the penetration of the Four Noble Truths, according to the classical model, will come through the sequential insights into usually it's expressed as impermanence, dukkha, or unsatisfactoriness, and non-self. But there are, as I said, numbers of cases of disciples who just pick up sometimes a phrase of Dharma, and somehow
it just clicks.
It seems that they don't undergo deliberate training in samadhi and vipassana.
Right.
But I would imagine that, again, that they sort of built up those qualities through previous lives, and then suddenly it's all coming together.
Right. Is it possible to train in formal meditation for many hours, and then when you arise out of meditation and you're just in a normal state, maybe it just clicks?
Oh, that happens quite often.
It's like an epiphany, right?
There are many cases like that.
Right. So it's like, it may not happen while you're on the cushion, but
Yeah.
All of a sudden it just clicks.
Yeah. Like there are cases where, I think of one example, it was the nun, I think Patachara. She was already a sotapanna, already a stream enterer. And then she had been meditating very earnestly, diligently, in order to reach the final stage, arhatship, but she couldn't attain it. Was it Bhattacharya. Yeah, so then she just, I think she must have been meditating outside our hut. So then she decided to give up and go back into our hut and take a rest. And she had a little lamp with her. And then as she was, you know, settled on the bed, about to go to sleep, she blew out the lamp. And just when she blew out the lamp, when the flame went out, boom, then the realization. Yeah. But don't think that, okay, I don't have to meditate, just take a lamp with me and blow it out. I mean, when I was living in Sri Lanka for many years, we didn't have electricity, and I blew out the kerosene lamp for 15 years every night. But I'm still a foolish enlightened.
Yeah, would you say that the first inner jnana would be related to this is suffering, and the second would be origin of suffering, and the third would be cessation of suffering?
In what?
Well, related to, like, say, the jnanas and the Four Noble Truths. Would they be related in any way? It seems like, I mean, what I think is that the first one, it seems more like this is suffering. In other words, it's like understanding it. And then it brings it into more like the origin, the second jhana. And the third jhana would be the cessation of suffering?
No.
Because it seems like our relation there is four, but it seems like everything is fading away. The way leading to the cessation of suffering seems the fourth jhana, which is actually insight.
The four jhanas or jnanas?
Jnana.
You mean that are mentioned here in this sutta?
No, it's not mentioned, of course. It's just something that I just seem to be more like related, for the Buddha brings everything in relation to the four noble truths. And I don't know if it has to do anything with this.
Yeah. It's something that I've never thought about it, and it doesn't seem to quite work out.
Sorry.
But I'll have to look into it, but I just never thought along those lines. I think we'll have to stop now to end this session, and then we can come back. We'll come back at 12:30 and then have some discussion. And now, the last two classes we've been discussing mindfulness of breathing, and now next weekend there's going to be at least a short weekend retreat on mindfulness of breathing. So you could put it into practice instead of just hearing about it. So I'm not going to have the class next week. And then the week after, I won't be around. I have to go to New Hampshire. So we will have the next class on August, I think it's the 16th. Next week, next Saturday is August 2nd. Then August 9th, I'm gone. And 9 plus 7 is 16? Okay, so the next class will be August 16th. And then we will hopefully go through the rest of the sutta in that class. And I want to encourage all of you to register for the retreat if you're able to over that weekend. Probably if you go up to the office, you can register, or else go online and register online. And then... Really? They can go and register in person. Oh, I see. I'm pretty sure that if there are spaces open, that you can register. Probably they set a deadline in order to encourage people to register early. But if there are vacancies, you can register. Okay, so let us share the merits. Okay, so we share the merits with the devas, the buddhas, the deities, the fear spirits, the dragon spirits, and with all beings, and wishing that they might be well and happy, protect the Buddha Dharma, and then protect ourselves, others, and the world. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantang Anumodipa Shirang Rakantu Sasanam Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantang Anumodipa Shirang Rakantu Desanam Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantang Anumodipa Chiram Rakantu Mam Param Etavata Chamhehi Sampadam Punya Sampadam Sabe Devanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Etavata Chamhehi Sampadam Punya Sampadam Sabe Bhutanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Etavata Chamhehi Sampadam Punya Sampadam Sabe Sadanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Bhavagupadaya Avichihetato Etantare Satakayupapana Rupiya rupicha asanya sanino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibutin. Okay, we end with three kathas from Buddha.
Out of bondage.